Many of us will have heard the phrase, you will own nothing and be happy. And just last month, the EPA implemented a rule, seemingly in service of this agenda, that will even by the EPA's own admission, put many small and medium meat processing facilities and cattle producers out of business. Only those that can afford to reduce their processing of animal products will be able to bypass these new EPA regulations. This example of bureaucratic overreach is in service of a larger goal of controlling the land, ostensibly to stop climate change. Will it succeed? Here on Fallout, today we have a special guest, physician and local rancher, Dr. Brooke Miller. And we'll get to learn about where he thinks all of this is heading.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Fallout. I'm Yanya Kellick. I'm the senior editor with Epoch Times. Of course, we're here with Dr. Robert Malone, the star of Fallout. And also, we've got Dr. Brooke Miller with us as well. And you're a different kind of doctor.
No, he's not. He's my physician.
Yeah.
Well, no. He's a real doctor.
So we've got a Dr. MD and we've got a Dr. PhD MD.
I am a different doctor. I'm a doctor and a rancher.
That's right. That's mm-hmm. right. Absolutely. Well, yeah. So what we're going to talk about today is, number one, we're going to look at basically how these new rules that may actually end up edging out the small producers, cattle producers, and I guess processors, really, if this is what the new rule is targeting.
Yes.
And the other thing is this 30 by 30 plan, which I discussed years ago in 2021, actually became aware of it. Then Governor Ricketts, now Senator Ricketts in Nebraska, had been sort of championing this, pushback against this 30 by 30 plan, you know, to get 30% of land in America basically under federal jurisdiction or federal protection, ostensibly. Now it's 12%. So let's talk about that.
Yeah, what really shocks me about this is that it comes on the heels of this Supreme Court ruling about West Virginia versus EPA having to do with the Clean Air Act and kind of the arbitrary and capricious activities of the EPA as it relates to air quality. And the Supreme Court clearly made a decision that the EPA doesn't have the authority to go outside of the bounds of the statute and start doing its own rulemaking. And here we have the EPA acting directly using the Clean Water Act. And again, an arbitrary and capricious fashion based on, you know, modest levels of phosphorus and nitrogen in wastewater from animal processing facilities. And because of that, they're going to force these small slaughterhouses to implement some really high-tech solutions to solve the problem of wastewater that contains phosphorus and nitrogen, which of course is the stuff that we put on our fields as fertilizer on a routine basis, right?
Yeah, exactly. And this just looks like bureaucratic overreach and shows that our country is being run by the bureaucrats, and they really aren't accountable.
So, you know, about a year ago, we were over at your farm, and a fellow named Texas Slim was over there showing us how every part of the cow can be used and eaten and so forth, and I got to see your farm for the first time. But how did this whole process happen? I think you told me, or he told me back then, that it's been a 30-year process of these, both the producers and the processors are basically being consolidated hard.
Currently, there are four major corporations, multinational corporations, that control 85% of the processing and basically protein market worldwide. And they are exerting their power and their influence through the regulatory agencies. And I think this ruling is probably part of that. They have basically monopolized our industry, and we can now see that we have a national cow herd. In other words, the total cow numbers in the United States are smaller than they have ever been since 1951. And that is a direct result of the lack of profit that producers claim or get from raising cattle. And while the packers are making billions of dollars each year. They don't compete. And Texas Slim, as you mentioned, is part of a movement that we've been seeing, a growing movement since the onset of COVID, where we're trying to bypass the big packers. And how do we bypass the big packers? Is we use small and medium-sized processing facilities to market our cattle directly to consumers. So this is really an assault on not only our ability to market our cattle, but consumers' ability to decide where and what type of food they want to eat. And what happens is you have people like me who do this because they love it. And most of the people in the cattle industry do it because they love it. They love it the way of life. But their children are growing up and they see how hard it is and how unprofitable it is. And they're going to do other things. So this is turning into a national security crisis for our country because we are outsourcing our food to foreign countries. Currently, we are a net importer of beef as opposed to a net exporter. And we have some of the best genetics and the best ranchers in the world. And we could produce far more food in this for this country and worldwide than what we're doing. But unfortunately, the regulatory capture that we've seen and the ability of these big corporations to influence our lawmakers has stacked the deck against our production agriculture model.
So why don't we look at the actual wording of this thing? And the whole history of this is really quite recent. It's just came out in January, right, as a rule or as a draft rule. Then they asked for a comment period up until March 23rd or something like that. And then the comment period closed, and I think it was the next day they issued the rule. So this is the EPA's summary of the rule. This is a mouthful. The Environmental Protection Agency is proposing a regulation to revise the technology-based effluent limitations guidelines and standards, or ELGs, in case you were unclear, for the meat and poultry products point source category. The proposed rule would improve water quality and protect human health and the environment by reducing the discharge of nutrients and other pollutants to the nation's surface waters. EPA is proposing several regulatory options, including the preferred option discussed in this notice. The preferred option is estimated to cost $232 million annually and reduce pollutant discharges by approximately 100 million pounds per year. What are the effluents that they're talking about? Like I said, it's nitrogen and phosphorus. Apparently, they spent years trying to detect viruses and other pathogens associated with these otherwise approved and compliant meat packing facilities, and they couldn't detect the bacterial or viral burden, and they came down to just these two things that are really fertilizer ingredients that every farmer puts on their fields, nitrogen and phosphorus.
Yeah, I had a local Southern States rep come by the other day wanting to sell me some fertilizer for our hay ground, and that's exactly what they were going to put on the fields was nitrogen and phosphorus.
Probably plus some calcium.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is much akin to what's being claimed in Europe as justification for trying to push the farmers off of their lands is particularly nitrogen runoff.
Tell us what that they want to put this solid waste into. What do they want to change it into?
Yeah, so they apparently what they want to do is gasification. So they want to
CO2 and methane.
And methane.
Yeah.
As which are obviously
makes
according
a lot of
to
sense,
them a greenhouse gases,
makes
right?
A lot of sense.
So that's what they want this waste to go into.
Mm-hmm. They want to take solid substances which could be theoretically spread on the land and they want to gasify it, which the entire climate change hysteria is based on CO2 and methane, and they want to make more of it.
Right, without any notification or acknowledgement of that contradiction.
Are there any theories out there as to why they may have chosen this? Because you would think that the people that deeply believe that this is an existential threat, wouldn't they be concerned about this?
You would think so, if they truly believed in it. This looks like a heavy-handed rule that had an agenda that is trying to put small packers out of business. Why? Because small farmers can market their cattle directly to the consumers, and it doesn't benefit the big multinational corporations. Control the food, control the people.
So the other contradiction here is that this is completely flies in the face of this announcement from Tom Vilsack in November of 2022, when he says Biden-Harris administration is investing $73 million in 21 grant projects through the first round of the meat and poultry processing expansion program. So they said they were going to drop in the first round $73 million to try to improve the and enhance the number of small processing facilities.
Yeah, and I asked that question to our committee chair for small packing in the United States Cattlemen Association. His response was that money's gone. It went to keeping the government open. The money was never used.
So it got reappropriated, and now they've come out with this from a separate agency other than USDA or Interior. They're coming out from EPA, making this rule that essentially is shutting these folks down.
They're accomplishing exactly the opposite what they said their stated goals were in November of 2022.
So is anybody in Congress doing anything about this?
Well, there's the Beef Act.
Which is what?
Basically, it is trying to rein in the EPA and saying that they have no right to jurisdiction over this and that they can't make this rule.
So this thing, this behemoth, is 64 pages of new regulatory language that these meat packers are going to have to comply with.
Well, we're going to see massive losses of probably the older packing plants that serve the communities. It will negatively impact farmers and ranchers indirectly, because if they don't have packing capacity to send their cattle to, they'll have to send them through the commodity market, where the packers already control that and suppress our live cattle prices.
Explain that to me. How does it work now?
Basically, you have your cow-calf producers, and they produce calves and then they go to a back grounder and grow them out, and eventually they go to a feedlot. And these feedlots sell these animals to packing plants. Well, if there's no free market competition, the packers pretty much set their price. They don't have two people bidding on it. There's no actual free market, because there are four of them that control 85% of the market. So they have a monopoly there. And so the use of small and regional packing plants is a way to bypass that monopoly and market directly to the consumer, and the consumer is able to see exactly how their animals are raised, who raised them, what practices they use, what they're fed, and they know a lot more about their food, and it's a lot healthier. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things with COVID-19 is we saw a couple of large packing plants shut down because they had some workers that were sick, and we saw temporary reduction in their packing capacity or their processing capacity. We saw shortages of meat at the meat counter. Ultimately, consumers paid tremendous higher prices at the meat counter, and they also gave the farmers and ranchers a tremendous reduction in the value of their animal. In other words,
the packers squeezed everybody.
They squeezed everybody, and they made so much money during that. They recorded record profits during the pandemic. They made more profits during the pandemic than they did before and after the pandemic, because they were able to squeeze both ends. And consumers saw that, and they finally said, hey, my food doesn't come from the grocery store. It comes from a grower. It comes from a farmer and a rancher. And there's one right down the road. Why don't I go talk to him? And hey, do you ever sell any of your beef? I get that question all the time. Do you ever sell any of your beef? And I say, yes. He goes, well, how can I get some?
So this here in Virginia, there's a lot of smaller cattle producers that are selling direct to market, and you're one of them.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And we get our beef from you. So you're able to
You're supposed to say
send,
it's the best beef you've ever had.
It is absolutely the best beef. So your local slaughterhouse that you ship your steers to, mm-hmm. What is it going to cost them? Their costs are going to be comparable with the rest of the industry. What's the impact on those poor guys?
It's going to be, you know, financially devastating for them. I mean,
we've heard estimates.
It's
going to be $20,000?
We've heard estimates $300,000 to $400,000, up to $1 million to $1.5 million for them to upgrade their facilities in order to meet these regulations.
So they're not, so that they're no, remember EPA Clean Water Act is supposed to be for navigable waterways.
Yes, most of these waters are well waters.
Yeah, so they're not discharging in navigable waterways.
No. So this is a real novel application of the law, so to speak. Or
it's a total stretch.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
To reduce a small amount of waste of nitrogen and phosphorus that are essentially fertilizers.
We will see lawsuits, I predict. I'm sure we will see lawsuits.
And the EPA kind of, from their own statements, they really don't care. They estimate between 16 and 845 facilities will shut down.
Yeah.
And that's okay. It's really the climate agenda.
Oh, you're exactly right, because you can bypass this by reducing the amount of beef that you process.
So that's their proposed solution.
Yes.
Is drop 1 million to 1.5 million, or just stop producing so much animal product.
Exactly. Exactly. Control the food, control the people.
Right.
Yeah.
And so this kind of plays into this other agenda of...
Control the land.
Controlling the land, yeah.
Right. The packers, the multinational packers, control the chicken industry and they control the hog industry because they can do that in confinement. They have tried to completely control the cattle industry, and one thing that they have not been able to do to control the cattle industry is because they cannot control the land. They cannot own that much land and they cannot control that much land. Those cattle are grazing places in this world that have no other use. The only use is for cattle and agriculture. You can't till it. Rough land, you can't till it. There's some of these public lands in the West that the cattle are good for the public lands, but they're trying to push them off. They've been trying to push them off for 30 years. They've reduced grazing allotments. They've used environmental standards or made up environmental standards to try to reduce cattle production.
Well, they're also trying to really redirect groundwater to urban areas, right? And
yep.
That's been another part of the justification, is to get the ranchers off the land so they can appropriate the groundwater and redirect it towards the big cities. Isn't that part of it?
Yep.
Well, I'll have to also direct our viewers to a recent American Thought Leaders episode with Margaret Byfield, who's
been kind of in the thick of
all this stuff for quite some time.
Margaret is one of the big heroes here, I think, in really pushing this. And she comes from direct experience in her dad's ranch in the West of having been shut down by this kind of regulatory overreach.
But this is really interesting what you're saying, that somehow, so the beef industry is different than these other industries just because of the larger amounts of land required? Is
Absolutely.
That how it works?
Yes. Chicken and pork, they basically eat a concentrated ration. Cattle grow up and they eat basically grass and hay until they go to the big feedlots. But they're raised mainly on grass and hay. And in order to raise grass and hay, you have to have millions of acres of land. And the large packers have not been able to totally control our industry and totally vertically integrate our industry because of that fact.
And so now there's this push, Agenda 2030 and Biden's 30 by 30 proposal to basically sequester a lot of the highly productive lands and rewild it, allow it to go back to what was claimed to be its original state. And this is all justified based on climate change and on species extinction.
They want to sequester the equivalent of 9 states of Nebraska in addition to what is right now.
That's crazy. Absolutely insane. That they want to do. It's basically about control. You have to get ranchers off the land in order to control them. If ranchers can't produce food for people, then they will rely on the government or, government corporate partnerships.
And also trying to get us to migrate to these alternative food sources, including synthetic meats, etc. Are they going to succeed in this?
No.
And what's the long-term agenda?
The long-term agenda, I think we all know the long-term agenda is the 15-minute cities, and you will own nothing and you'll be happy about it.
So trying to pack people into dense urban areas and sequester the land away This seems to be part of a population control logic.
Yeah.
Well, the Paul Ehrlich view of the world, right? Like that humanity is kind of a blight on the planet. I love wildlands. You know, in fact, I became a biologist because I wanted to spend time in wildlands and not among people, not in necessarily Washington, D.C. You know, life is kind of funny that way sometimes. Uh-huh. You know, I didn't think about stewardship, for example, as an alternate model for treating the land well.
During my lifetime, I have known a lot of Western ranchers, and I've spent a lot of time on Western ranchers, and there are no better stewards of the land than someone who owns private ownership. Right. They're innovative, and they love the land. That's why they're there. They're not desecrating the land. They're trying to take care of the land. And those privately owned ranches are in much better ecosystems than these publicly, federally owned properties that are under federal control.
And my understanding is that what the government is, the U.S. government is trying to do with this 30 by 30 program is get those ranchers to place their lands functionally under federal control through financial incentives to get them to put them into conservation easements. Mm. So you get a little bit of money now.
Sort of like giving donuts for mRNA drugs.
Yeah, that's right. It is a little bribe.
Yeah,
a little bribe. What could possibly go wrong? Here's free money.
Yeah, free
right.
Money,
the same kind of program. It's free money, but there's a fish hook in there.
Yes.
And the fish hook is that then the EPA and all these other agencies are going to be able to come in and inspect your land and tell you what you have to do with it and how you have to do it because you've signed off for the program and you took the money.
Exactly. Exactly.
So that seems to be a strategy that we hear again and again. That's the way to get around states' rights in everything.
Yeah, that's what my dad told me. My dad was still alive when these conservation easements came about, and he said, son, you never give up your rights. You'll never get them back. You never give up your rights.
Right now, it's 30% of the land by 2030, mm-hmm. but the overall objective is to get to 50% of the earth placed into wild reserves.
30% by 2030, that's actually from Agenda 2030.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Well, it was signed off by Obama.
Right, right.
So, and it was done under this executive authority, mm-hmm. which we're learning more and more about during the debate regarding the World Health Organization and the international health regulations, wherein the Senate doesn't end up actually taking a two-thirds vote to approve a treaty. These agreements are put in place as executive agreements, but they apparently have been determined by international courts and supported by the Supreme Court as having the force of a treaty, even though they've only come through an executive agreement from the president. And that's how Agenda 2030 got passed, and it's interpreted globally. We're all scratching our heads trying to make sense out of the open border policy, not just in the United States. People forget the same thing has been happening in Europe to the same end, disruption of cultures, major upheavals, protests, etc. The same kind of thing we're seeing here in the States and so many people are afraid of with this massive illegal immigration. And that is all grounded in a clear statement in the UN Agenda 2030 with now the force of treaty and international law that it's a fundamental human right to migrate wherever you want to live. Nobody was told about it. There was no debate. We didn't have any action in the Senate. And so no one heard about it until they started implementing it.
Yeah, I think we'll have to do a deep dive into that, into that situation.
Well, what underlies it, Jan, that's really been bothering me, and it's as I say, it's come to fore because of the World Health Organization Pandemic Treaty Initiative and the international health regulations, is that it turns out, as you know, because you know some of the international lawyers that have been discussing this, is there is a real debate going on within the world of constitutional scholars, academics, and otherwise, about whether or not treaties can supersede the Constitution, as the Biden administration is doing, enabling these treaties, such as the WHO pandemic treaty, which have clauses which seem to violate fundamental clauses in the Constitution, such as free speech and personal autonomy, property rights, etc., and really undermined both domestic sovereignty and personal sovereignty. And my understanding, because there's a specific case of Pink versus the United States, there is significant case law indicating that, in fact, these treaties can create a socket between international law and our national law and enable international courts, such as happened with the Cool Rule decision, mm-hmm. right? That Cool Rule decision is crucial because it is a great example of where we had the North American Free Trade Agreement, mm-hmm. and we had an objection to U.S. practices that about labeling, which is fundamentally free speech.
Yeah,
and they objected to those labeling as mm-hmm. in some way violating the North American Free Trade Agreement, mm-hmm. and they succeeded in that challenge. Mm-hmm. And American beef farmers and the American beef industry had to change their practices, their labeling practices, right. as a consequence.
Well, right, and that's using the WTO as yeah. as the kind of mechanism, the enforcement mechanism. So I guess, you know, what you're arguing here, this is now we're going to be using the WHO or something like that.
And to your point, yeah. in the pandemic treaty, so the question is, because the pandemic treaty has these clauses that the director general can basically mandate responses, including all the way to you shall take this drug or this vaccine, to public health events of international concern. So Tedros would have the ability under this to force that kind of implementation, and that right now the administration seems to be totally okay with that.
Well, to me the biggest concern is just this: we've already seen what it looks like, even when there isn't actual force of law, right? If someone comes out and says, "Well, these are just guidelines."
Yeah,
right.
That's the right? old IHRs were yeah. just supposed to be guidelines.
Right. The guidelines have been used as the excuse to implement yeah. the effectively something yeah. like a mandate in many mm-hmm. cases. Like they were treated that way, and then everyone has plausible deniability. I didn't do anything. What did you do? Anything? I didn't do anything.
Right.
There was just a suggestion.
I didn't mandate yeah. anything. You
know? Which is the same position the CDC yeah. and the FDA are taking right now, because they don't actually have the right to regulate the practice of medicine in the United States. It's exactly analogous. If you liked what the CDC and the FDA did during COVID, you're going to absolutely love the new international health regulations and the WHO pandemic treaty.
So Robert, I think this is actually a great place to wrap, but these international health regulations and pandemic treaty, I think we got to cover them on Fallout one more time before they actually get voted on in May.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And Brooke, you know, you're kind of having a very interesting activity coming up at the farm, your farm ranch. I don't know. I never know what to call it, right? But why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, this coming Friday, we're going to have one of our herd health days, where we're going to run basically every animal through the chute, and we're going to pregnancy check the cows. We're going to vaccinate the calves to try to ensure their good health after we take them off the mamas in about a month, and get your viewers to see a little bit about what goes into raising cattle. And I think it would be something good for them to view. And
I think we'll definitely have to send a camera over there, and we'll include it as part of our episode. So, you know, Brooke, it's been fantastic having you on.
Thank you very much, Jan. I've always respected you as a top flight journalist, the best journalist in the world, in my opinion, and I'm very honored to be on your program. And I'm very honored to be sitting beside this gentleman right here, who I also love and respect. And
And you're doing your best to keep me healthy.
Absolutely, absolutely. And if Jan wants to come out and see me, if he ever feels the need to come out and see me, I'd be happy to take care of him as well.
Brooke, thank you so much. So with that, let's bring our viewers over to Ginger Hill Angus and see, you know, how a proper roundup is done.
Thanks for coming down, Robert, today. As you know, we're at Ginger Hill Angus, and we're having our annual herd health day. We'll run every cow and calf through the chute. The cows will be vaccinated and pregnancy tested. The calves will be vaccinated for viral diseases that seem to hit on them in times of stress, such as weaning, when we'll be weaning in about a month from now. And as you can see, we're out here on a beautiful day. It's raining. That's farming and ranching. You pretty much do it no matter what you dealt. You deal with it.
The cows don't mind, and the grass doesn't mind.
No, the grass is loving it.
I think what's amazing is that you've got a vet here that's going to be not only preg checking but sexing those cows in utero.
Yes, yes.
In real time.
Yes.
I had no idea you could do that.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing what they can do. He has an ultrasound probe. He doesn't even have to stick his arm. You know, it used to be you have to stick your arm up in the cow's rectal area and feel through the rectal wall and feel the size of the calf and to get the pregnancy date on it. And he's got an ultrasound probe that does all that, and he just has to interpret it. So let's go see what they're doing. Here at Ginger Hill Angus, this is definitely a family affair. Eddie, who's not here right now, works here 5 days a week pretty much and takes care of the place while I'm at the office. But Henry, my son, my daughter-in-law, the children all pitch in. We need a lot of help on days like today. And then we have friends like Blake and Cody, who pretty much are my kids too. I adopted them. So it's a big deal, and I depend on a lot of people to keep this operation running. So as you can see, this chute is run off hydraulics. It's one of the Cadillacs of the business. Dr. Cummin has had this made specifically for himself. And
she's good on me.
Good. It holds the cow completely still, so she's not injured, and nobody that's working on her is injured. It's a lot easier on everybody.
How does this whole chute business work?
Well, this is called a Bud's box, where it's sort of a low stress handling way to handle cattle. You run the cows in here. They come from these pens out here, and then when they come in, they want to go back out the same way they came, but for some reason they will file in through here very easily. And this is an alleyway that is curved. They seem to work better through a curved alleyway. And these are stops when they get past them. And you see the cow just sort of walks right through. And as you notice on the chute, on the squeeze chute, he will always open the rear end before he lets the cow
right
out, because the cow wants to follow her.
And it pushes the forward one out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cool. They act like they've been through this rodeo before.
Yeah, they know what they're doing. The calves, it's a little bit difficult because some of them will turn around in the chute, and then you have to get in there and turn them around. But the cows pretty much know. They've been through here before.
Yeah, they're acting like it.
We try to handle them in a low-stress type manner, and if you handle them in a low-stress manner, they're not going to stress you out.
How many head do you run on this ranch right now?
Right now, there are about 250 to 300 head of cattle here.
That includes the calves?
That includes the calves, yes.
Okay, and then they were out here in these fields, right?
Exactly.
And this morning you ran them in, and then you separated them.
Yeah, well, we incentivize them.
Uh-huh.
Okay? Anytime I want to move them, I always take them someplace, like new grass. That's an incentive. So they'll pretty much come to me when I call them.
Yeah, I've seen
you may
that.
Have to push some stragglers in. Well, we get them into the barn lot, we give them a treat.
Uh-huh.
And so they willingly come in
uh-huh.
and get the treat.
Uh-huh.
So that's just part of being able to handle 250 cows by yourself with one or two people.
Yeah, so they get grain.
Yeah, they get grain when they come in. That's the only time they get grain. Generally, we're just a grass and hay operation on the cow herd. They get what Mother Nature supplies.
When did you breed all these cows?
We started breeding them. We turned bulls out, and we started artificially inseminating around the 1st of December. They all don't get bred on the first service. Most of them do, thank goodness. That's one of our selection criteria, is to have cows that calve in a small calving window in a bunch. The cows cycle every 21 days.
So right now, they're pretty much, they've all taken.
We're hopeful.
Yeah.
That's what Dr. Cummin is going to tell us, if there are any surprises, if there are any cows in here that are not pregnant.
Yeah. And the tagging is absolutely critical. As I recall, the USDA requires it, right?
Well, these are our own personal ID tags. Now, these cows do have their own personal permanent identification on their side. It's a Freeze brand where we do this once a year, where Cody and Blake and all the kids come and we have a big party in the fall, and we freeze brand the yearlings. So as you notice, they have a number on their side, and they have our Ginger Hill brand on their hip. And that's where you freeze the melanin in the skin, and it grows back white.
Yeah, so it's a lot more humane than the old
pop branding.
Oh, gosh,
yes. And they also have an electronic ID tag, so if we want to ship them across state lines, the USDA requires that they have permanent identification. And they have one
so
of those.
So they use an ear tag instead of a chip, an injected chip.
Yeah, it's an ear tag that's put in their ear.
Okay.
Yeah. I can pretty much recognize all these cows without their tags. I mean, I know them just like I know Robert and I know Blake. But we do have permanent tags for other people that come here or work here so they can identify them. We have an ear tag in their ear. If you're looking head on, you can't see their side. And then we also have a brand on their side that you can see. So this was a cow that was open. She's 12 years old. She slipped her calf last fall, and she was such a good cow, I kept her around to breed, but there's obviously something wrong with her reproductively, so she has reached the end of her productive life.
Tell me about why people ought to get Ginger Hill beef and locally produced beef.
Well, that's a good question. With the shortages that we saw with the COVID-19 pandemic on beef in the grocery store, it made everybody completely aware that there is a problem with our distribution chain, and we have a big monopoly in the cattle business. And in the meat packing business. And they're squeezing out farmers and ranchers, and that is making our food supply not as abundant. And I think it's important for people to try to establish a relationship with a good local direct source of beef and not through a commodity source of beef. So there has been a big movement for people in urban areas to come out here and meet ranchers and shake ranchers' hands and look and see how the animals are cared for, how they're grown, and how wholesome and healthy the food is and how we take care of the land. You can figure out what they feed their cattle, what they're exposed to, what vaccines they do and don't get.
Now, I know in terms of us deciding to buy from Ginger Hill, which we're very glad to do, for us, it's really reassuring that we know that you're not giving them a bunch of hormones and you're taking care of the animals well. I mean, you know that as a physician too, that it's important that the consumer controls the nature of the food they're getting.
Yes, we're fortunate we live out here in the country and we can raise our own beef, but we also rely on neighbors and other farmers for chickens, eggs, pork, and fruits and vegetables. For those people that are living in urban areas, there are people that do this on a larger scale than what we're doing. We're mainly a breeding stock operation here, but do it on a larger scale, and they ship, and they will ship it, UPS it or FedEx it right to your door.
Now, another thing, we were talking the other day about the 30 by 30 initiative and the whole logic underpinning that somehow the federal government is going to be better at protecting the land than the ranchers and farmers are. I mean, this is a great example. This has been in your family for generations and generations. And it kind of feels like when we buy beef from you, we're supporting a whole family infrastructure of people, just like we saw running that chute today.
When you buy directly from a farmer or a rancher, not only are you getting a better product, but you are supporting his way of life so that he can continue to grow and produce food. I mean, this is where we live. And I mean, you can look at the quality of the pastures. You can tell it's been well cared for. And these cattle are part of that whole process. They are part of the ecosystem, and their hooves break up the soil and break and they eat the grass and they prevent the weeds.
And they fertilize.
And they fertilize.
So Brooke, thanks a lot for having us out here today and letting us film this whole little operation. And I look forward to seeing you next week here on Fallout.